And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest, the Right Reverend Bishop Sean Manchester. And get ready for this one. Bishop, welcome to Coast. So good to have you with us tonight.
Good morning. Or is that good evening there?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both with the depth of this program. And
What day are you on? Is it the 15th or the 16th in America?
Well, this is coming along into Monday night into Tuesday. So it's 16, soon to be into 17 eventually.
All right. I just asked because it was my birthday yesterday. I just wondered if I could extend it slightly, but apparently not.
Well, happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much.
Evil, is it still around, this planet?
Very much so, perhaps more so than ever before, as evinced in events that are world news almost every day now. Traditional Christianity has steadily continued to defend the classical paradigms, despite many modernists today no longer subscribing to a literal supernatural reality that personifies evil. Yet few can deny the existence of the devil, who is real, not a figment of the imagination, at work all the time. He will eventually be judged by God, but I believe, as do all traditionalists, that he exists as a personal and real form and entity. There are two reasons, basically. One, because the Bible says so, and the other is because I've confronted him personally.
And I want to hear about that story of the confrontation and what got you to specialize, if I can use that word, in this field.
There are many reasons, and it's complex. There are the more intimate reasons to do with my early life, which chronicled briefly in some of my written works. But equally, around the time I joined the Roman Catholic Church in the early 60s would have been around the time the Second Vatican Council was beginning to bite. And those landmarks and signposts that had existed for so long, certainly for centuries, were suddenly to be blown down. And concepts, I mean, in the days of Pius V, a future saint,
mm-hmm.
who'd started his life as a shepherd boy, you would read in that missal the decree that at no time in the future can a priest ever be forced to use any other way of saying Mass. And in order once for all to preclude any scruples of conscience and fear of ecclesiastical penalties and censures, we declare herewith that it is by virtue of our apostolic authority that this decree must last in perpetuity and can never at a future date be revoked or legally amended. And that is just one of the things that Vatican II did. It revoked and legally amended sacrament at the very center of its existence, the Eucharistic celebration of the Mass, which today bears very little resemblance to that which was being celebrated in the church I joined.
But what happened to you for you to begin to become, I would guess, the person that tried to eradicate this evil in the different areas that you've been into? Of course, you know, you're the founder of the Vampire Research Society, and we'll talk about that this evening. But did anything happen in your life to make you do what you do now?
Well, on that level, I became aware in the early 60s that things were not as they should be. The priest who instructed me admitted as much himself, but he didn't seem to mind. He was less bothered by that and almost welcomed it. But then I found that he was not the best example of someone who should be instructing, given that he had an alcohol problem and certainly enjoyed the worldly pleasures. And his great, I suppose, fame was being able to get through a mass in under 15 minutes. This didn't appeal to me enormously. And at first I just thought this was a sign of the times, that one had to realize that things change. But then I, as I progressed, I realized that there was much more to it than that, that things don't, in fact, have to change at all, and that since the last World War, the Second World War, there has been very likely an orchestrated conspiratorial effort to undermine the, amongst other institutions, certainly the Church, and certainly the Roman Catholic Church, and that what I was witnessing was the consequence of those who had joined seminaries at the end of the last World War and were now in positions of authority. Some people would go so far as to describe them as Satanists. Others would simply say they were people who had different ambitions to those one would normally associate with the Church. And on that level, I became very much aware that there was something afoot which was, to my mind, dark and sinister. On an entirely personal level, I think, bearing in mind where I was raised in the early years, in these somber avenues of Sherwood Forest, in the grounds of Newstead Abbey Park, where my grandparents lived, in a, very close to Newstead Abbey, the ruin inhabited by the Byrons for many centuries.
And is this the same Sherwood Forest that the legendary Robin Hood was
yes.
in? Oh, really?
Yes. And my grandmother encountered, and not a person who at all believed in such things, I hasten to add, encountered what can only be described as a malign and malevolent spectre of some sort on more than one occasion, but on the last it did cause her to fall down a large rockery. And she became so terrified by this nocturnal presence that would, I think, normally appear at either just after twilight, when she was just doing the final things that one does.
Yes.
Living in a woodland. They owned some 20 to 30 acres of woodland within Newstead Abbey Park. And she was so terrified that she persuaded my grandfather to consider relocation, which he did, and he was having a house built at Woolerton Park, nearby, but she didn't survive much longer, and the shock of her experience, the trauma, probably contributed to her premature death.
Oh, I'm sure
more than
it
did. Any other cause. And I think that, among other experiences, triggered my crusade, you might say.
Well, what kind of studies did you have to undertake to learn the things you did? Because you became a full-time exorcist. I mean, is there a place for you to go and learn? Or is this something that you must learn by some horrible experience?
I think... I mean, for me, I became formally an exorcist in early 1973 when I entered the minor order of the exorcistate. But throughout the previous decade, I had been privately studying and researching these matters concerned with demonology and vampirology, and would have, at that time, have been largely self-taught. Certainly then, outside of the church environment,
mm-hmm.
Which was not encouraging these things even back then, and certainly less so now, the subject, particularly aspects of it that I've specialized in, require a large degree of self-teaching.
And it also must be emotionally exhausting to do what you do, just by the nature of being surrounded by so much evil. That's got to be very difficult. How do you combat that?
Well, it is. I mean, the actual confrontational aspect is immensely exhausting, and just dealing sometimes on a day-to-day basis with the problems that arises from the fact of what you do. But one is not confronting supernatural evil all the time, on a conscious level, that is, by any means. And if one was, I mean, I don't think you would survive for too long. It would be too much.
That's true. Well, the organization that you founded, the Vampire Research Society.
Yes.
Give me, Bishop, your definition of what a vampire is, because we hear so many different things. I'd like to know from you, truly an expert, what you think a vampire is.
The definition of vampire is a demonic entity that sometimes assumes the form of a dead body, reanimated, as it were. And is distinct from other forms of manifestation insofar as it appears to drain not only the life, but the blood itself. The smallest drop of blood can be employed by a demonic entity, enabling the wraith to form a tangible form.
Wow.
Revenants are attracted to blood, which allows them to effect their purpose. The ancient Israelites, that is, wouldn't eat the blood of any flesh at all, because the life of the flesh was considered by them to be in the blood. The Hebrew word that translates as life in Deuteronomy 12, verse 23, only be sure not to eat the blood, for the blood is the life. Also, that same word also signifies the soul. So the vampire partakes the dark nature and mysterious qualities of both revenant and demon, but is distinct from each by the degree of its apparent lust for blood.
So the blood...
A demonologist must always be mindful of this alarming characteristic.
The blood in the stories of blood that we've all seen in movies and we read in books, that's real then?
Yes. Yes. This separates the vampiric manifestation from other forms of demonic interference, in that there is, and certainly in my experience, the taking of blood.
What possesses this entity to be like it is? Well, I mean, what creates the vampire? And there's got to be a reason for them.
Vampires have always existed. There is the tradition of the vampire as being, but this is talking of a person afflicted with the fatal malignity, that is, someone who has fallen victim. But those who are considered to have become vampires, is what I think you're getting at,
yes,
are generally described as attracting to themselves the evil itself through their own life and through what they've been doing in it. It's a tricky one, because the true vampire is demonic, and it's difficult to talk of the cause of vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, and Summers, Montague Summers, that is, the Reverend Montague Summers, my predecessor in many ways from an earlier time, who died about 4 years after I'd been born. He considered that a vampire, and this is based on his research and study from, I suppose, old documents, that a vampire is one who has led a life of more than ordinary immorality and unbridled wickedness, a person of foul, gross, and selfish passions, of evil ambitions, delighting in cruelty and blood, believed to be one who has devoted himself during his life to the practice of the black art. Summers concludes that it is hardly to be supposed that such persons would rest undisturbed, while it is easy to believe that their malevolence had set into action forces which might prove powerful for terror and destruction, even when they were in their graves.
Jeez. Are they human and they've been possessed by demons or something else?
Yes, there is that aspect. The victim certainly is suffering vampiric or demonic interference. There is a large question. Obviously, everyone who might die from vampire or the demonic attack. Vampire is a relatively recent word, and would have only been used in very recent centuries. But whatever label we put on this particular demonic manifestation, everyone understands what is meant when, today at least,
yes,
when one uses that word, very emotive word, vampire. Certainly a victim would suffer from the assault, and in some cases they do expire, often from blood loss.
Well, when we come back, Bishop, I'd like to find out how you can pinpoint a vampire, and then what do you do about it when you find one? Stick with me. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I want to invite all of you, by the way, to go to Art Bell's website, artbell.com. Click on tonight's guest and link up, if you would, with Bishop Sean Manchester's web address, and you will see some, I'm telling you, incredible stories. You know, the Vampire Research Society, for example, is something that you just need to see, and that will help you as you listen to our interview tonight. Bishop, can you tell if someone has been possessed or is a vampire merely by seeing them, or do you really have to find out what's going on in their particular life?
A bit of both, I think. I mean, most people who contact me and suspect vampiric activity have similar stories to tell of nocturnal visitations, something pressing on them as they sleep quietly in their beds, a heavy weight, eventually a depression of the spirits, a loss of weight, certainly a very anemic appearance, illness. It's really for the exorcist to determine whether in truth what their suffering is vampiric or some other form of a demonic attack.
You know what we have seen in movies where if a vampire is coming at you, you hold up a crucifix, or you go to bed with garlic around your neck. Is that just movie stuff?
No. The crucifix has been traditionally employed by the church, particularly in cases of unction, someone who is dying, someone who is gravely ill. In fact, the confraternity of the precious blood existed for the purpose of providing a crucifix to the condemned and the dying so that they might kiss it and confess. Yes, the crucifix is utterly abhorred by vampires. The object and what it is made of doesn't in itself possess any power, yet it is so strongly symbolic of the triumph of good over evil that almost it alone repels the evil, and or whatever emissary of evil is at large. However, when employed by a person, the intent and faith of the person employing it is sometimes paramount. This might seem like a paradox. Yes. Christian items and holy places certainly repel evil people, who oftentimes delight in attempting the sacrilege of such places. Likewise, supernatural evil shuns these holy things. I would suggest that the vampire fears and shrinks from all holy things, and certainly Christian images, the sign of the cross, the crucifix, relics, above all the host, the body of God. Holy water is hated by the vampire, who is also conquered by the fragrance of incense. Certain trees and herbs keep him away, the white thorn, and as you mentioned, garlic. Garlic is a has no, certainly no Christian connotation that I'm aware of, but it does go back to the classical world, where this pungent herb, Allium sativum, I think there's another, the wild variety is Allium venial, is deemed by many to be effective as a vampire repellent. It was used as early as the time of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians for warding off evil spirits.
See, and I just thought it was folklore. It's real.
It would seem so. I mean, I don't place reliance on garlic, but I have to, in all honesty, attest to its efficiency.
What about a stake in the heart, or is that just a fabrication?
No, the impalation of the contaminated corporeal form can, according to tradition and certainly practice, best be released in that in the immediate sense, in that way, if cremation isn't practical in the first instance. I mean, in past centuries, I mean, cremation wasn't always an option, because the church only in the last century, I think, actually allowed cremations to take place, which does solve the problem somewhat.
Well, what is it about a stake that would, I guess, let the soul rest, if I'm being accurate there?
It is a tricky one, because there is the metaphysical, the idea that the vampire, we're talking in its corporeal form, not the entity alone, but the corporeal manifestation that has occurred, which is tangible, has somehow breaks our laws, our scientific laws, and lives in a form of anti-time.
Anti-time.
Which impalation, destroying the organ, indeed, that ingests the blood, the life force, which permits the manifestation in the first place, it is the basis of that demonic tangible form, is the blood. And the very organ that ingests that blood being destroyed, somehow, almost miraculously, puts everything back to where it should be. The form is reduced to its correct natural state, and the entity, the true the vampire, the demon, is expelled or cast out or removed from that particular level of existence where it's interfering with us. It isn't destroyed, nor can it be destroyed.
Are these demons, Bishop, past souls, or are they manifestations all to themselves?
They're manifestations in themselves. They didn't become demons who were once people. They are part of the demonic legion referred to in the Bible. and therefore must be properly exercised. They have always existed, and they came about with the fall as rebellious spirits, spirit creatures, who rebelled against God and were cast out of heaven, to put it in very easy-to-understand terms.
Are vampires devils? Are they the same?
They're the Antichrist in many ways, as described in Thessalonians. I mean, the vampire, in truth, is a terrible parody of the resurrection. And we should know Satan's strategy, his modus operandi, which is the direct assault of lies and the art of deception. Satan's plan, the devil's plan, if you wish, is to replace God's own with his counterfeit. And we must be on the offensive and put on the armor of God in order to stand firm against the schemes of the devil, with whom our real struggle, and of course his demons, his emissaries, that's the real battle, the real conflict that is going on. This demonic legion, of which the vampire is one aspect, one manifestation, one part, came about when certain spirit creatures who were part of God's kingdom rebelled, led by Lucifer or Satan or the devil, whatever appellation we're talking of, the same evil one,
right?
Sometimes
right.
referred to, and have been rebelling ever since. And all the ill and darkness comes from that rebellion. And the vampire is one of the more extreme manifestations, and worrisome insofar as through the use of blood, human blood, is able to use that as a basis to become tangible and take on a corporeal form, and in fact appear to actually be, and perhaps in some instances actually be, a person's cadaver.
Jeez. Does it need the blood to thrive, as we've seen in Hollywood?
It needs the blood to manifest in a tangible form. Since demons cannot be destroyed, I'm often referred to as a slayer or a killer, which is palpable nonsense. These forms of supernatural evil, as with any other form of supernatural evil, can't be actually destroyed, slain, or killed. What they can be is removed.
But where do they go?
Hopefully back to where they came from. but that's our hope. Where they go is away from us, away from our plane of existence. The portal through which they came is from their abyss, their dark world, their nether region, as it were, either by invitation or otherwise. They have entered a portal into our dimension and level of life and experience.
See, and you've just brought something up that I've always wanted to find out about, this, I will call it the evil portal. When you said by invitation.
Yes.
There are some people who will conjure up this demonic spirit or this vampire, this whatever.
Yes.
And bring it through the portal.
That's right. I mean, in many of the major cases I've investigated, that aspect has been very much to the fore. There have been those engaged in necromantic diabolism who seem to have been doing everything in their power to evoke the very evil that an exorcist would certainly be in the business of expunging and ridding the world of.
Bishop Manchester, are there very secret groups or societies who are, as we speak, practicing this kind of demonic lifestyle?
Yes. It's difficult for anyone to understand why they would want to.
Yes.
But I would argue that there are secret societies, yes. And I think more and more is being spoken these days about them. But the trouble with people who dare to speak out, individuals, not unlike myself, is that they suffer the consequences of daring to speak out. Take, for example, somebody who has toured America and attracted large audiences, I believe, and toured the rest of the world, who by no means holds religious views anywhere, or if any at all, similar to mine, and indeed is probably against the Christian Church and all other institutions of faith. David Icke is portrayed both here and probably elsewhere as a lunatic, as a madman, by and large, by the media, whether it's the print media or radio and television stations. There might be the very rare station like your own that would be more open-minded and be willing to listen, at least, to what somebody has to say.
Are you concerned about your own safety?
Well, I mean, there's no way David Icke is a lunatic. I mean, he holds views that are out of step with the received wisdom of most and the consensus view of the day. But some of his ideas and views are extreme, but not when you view them against the whole context of history. They become less so. I'm sure he could speak for himself and tell of the slings and arrows he's suffered as a consequence of daring to speak his mind. I can only say that I've equally suffered censure and indeed censorship. I mean, back in 1929, my predecessor, the Reverend Montague Summers, published in one of his very worthwhile vampire books, Vampire, His Kith and Kin, I think, he said, whether we are justified in supposing that cases of vampirism are less frequent today than in past centuries, I'm far from certain. But one thing is plain, not that they do not occur, but that they are carefully hushed up and stifled. And I would certainly go along with that. I mean, the more I have spoken out, the more I've suffered censorship. In the years ago, I think whilst you could be viewed as an antediluvian, slightly eccentric character, nobody was really too put out. But once you started to provide evidence, I mean, in the 1990s, for example, I went on several television shows, mm-hmm. all independent of each other, but nationally transmitted shows live.
Yes, right.
And that was the essential point there. They were live, where photographs of evidence were, first of all, tested. That is, the panchromatic strip of 35mm film was examined. And the stills, the enlargements from those negatives were, in fact, put up on screen.
Next hour, will you share some stories and some of your personal experiences with vampires?
Yes, certainly.
Okay, very good. You stay with us. My guest is the Right Reverend, the Bishop Sean Manchester. He's the founder of what is called the Vampire Research Society. I'm George Norrie, and I'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie in for Art Bell, and Art shall be back when he's back. He's feeling pretty sore right now. My guest is the Reverend Sean Manchester, Bishop Manchester, vampires, demons, exorcisms. Bishop, the vampire itself, the being what it is, if you could relate just a few stories for us, personal stories, which I think will give us even a more clearer handle of what these things really are.
Right. Well, in 1963, Roger Williams of Huddersfield, which is in Yorkshire, England, witnessed the spectre of what appeared to be a medieval figure, female, whilst he was taking an autumnal stroll with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
This figure seemed to glide towards them with no sound of feet walking over the dry leaves and twigs as they themselves were making, and certainly struck terror in them. Another 9 years would pass before the apparition was seen again by the same person in Yorkshire, described as wearing a long garment and possessing mad staring eyes.
Jeez.
Set in a pale face. Both incidents, according to Roger Williams, were followed by paranormal activity at his house. And it seems that the area in West Yorkshire, at Kirklees, where this manifestation is alleged to have occurred, has had similar incidents going back centuries. In the winter of 1987, the Research Society observed in the earth above one of the tombs on unconsecrated land in the immediate vicinity, finger-width holes. Animals drained of blood were discovered in the immediate area, and it was learned that nearby villagers had been obliged to call in priests to exorcise their homes of some form of malignant force. My first vigil, as it were, at the site itself, where there are unconsecrated graves on private land, took place in the the Easter thereabouts in 1990, 12 years ago. I had two other researchers with me, and we came across the crumbling ruin of a priory gatehouse, which itself had been the sinister setting of a murder way back in 14th century, I think.
Yeah.
There were several occult symbols etched into it, into the side of some say they're Masonic symbols. Some identified them as being satanic. They were etched into the priory garden wall and at the building itself. The place, the area indeed, was infused with a lingering atmosphere of malevolence that might have set into action powerful forces. Once we'd left the priory ruin, now desecrated by time and neglect, and approached the grave itself, which for centuries had lain forgotten beneath a canopy of trees and intertwining ivy and tendrils of vineweed.
Yes.
Protected by a dense woodland undergrowth and a cloak of green yew trees. Sunlight could hardly ever penetrate the area, but it was just enough to illuminate the ornate iron railings for visitors. Whilst all this was taking place, one researcher we'd left behind had made the discovery of a dismembered goat, completely drained of blood, We remained in vigil, watching the general area, mm-hmm. rather reminiscent of the of scenes back in Highgate at the turn of the 70s, where, of course, in Highgate Cemetery, it was forbidden to disturb the tranquility of the tomb. So the only alternative would have been to wait the vampire's return, as it were. To its lair. And this is precisely what we were doing here in West Yorkshire.
Is there an air about it when you're there waiting? I mean, can you feel evil at all, Bishop?
Well, certainly in both cases, Highgate Cemetery and the Kirklees Estate in West Yorkshire, there is an atmosphere of gloom, and I suppose, yes, you would say malevolent evil has a very depressing and oppressing effect. I only know that in the case of the Yorkshire case, one of my research assistants, the one that had been left behind, did witness something very similar to the 1963 and 1972 spectre.
I'd hate to be the one left behind.
Yeah, well, that person remained behind, I think, partly out of trepidation of being so close to the area itself.
Yeah.
But we heard it wafting on the night air like a discordant sound. At first, we thought it might be the wind howling in the trees, but it grew louder and closer, and was perceptibly a wailing noise.
And this was from the vampire?
Presumably, yes.
Okay.
I'd brought along a small case of antidotes and implements and instruments,
mm-hmm.
and grabbed hold of a large crucifix and stepped into the path of from where the unearthly groaning was approaching, really. It's getting louder. And gave this a briefest of exorcism rites. As one has to in these emergency situations. And it immediately ceased as soon as I did. As soon as I raised the crucifix and cried out, "Behold the light," the approaching wailing and the atmosphere lightened slightly, and the noise, which at first, it has to be said, when we first of all heard it, we thought it was our companion in the distance groaning.
Sure, the one that was left behind.
Possibly having been caught on some sharp brambles or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it continued and became more discordant and was clearly not of this earth. And when we spoke to him afterwards, he reported that the source of the original noise we had heard was, of course, not him, but a darkly clad woman who at first appeared serene, then rapidly manifested into a wraith with almost red eyes, staring and horrible. Absolutely not his imagination, he insisted.
Has anybody ever captured these on film?
Well, only in the case of the perhaps most famous vampire investigation, certainly of the 20th century, which was the Highgate vampire. And these pictures were transmitted several times on British television. And they are, of course, published in my work, The Highgate Vampire. And that case began in 1967. Well, the incidents began that were brought to my attention commenced in 1967 with...
That was like a 13-year episode, wasn't it?
Well, yes. When the investigation proper commenced in 2 years later in 69, it lasted a full 13 years before the case file was finally closed.
Well, and how do you close a case file on something like this? What determines that it's been closed?
A successful exorcism, really, and there was more than one. I mean, the main exorcism of what was generally regarded and described as the Highgate vampire, the source, that took place as early as the beginning of 1974. But there were subsequent contaminations that continued on till 1982. It all began, really, when two 16-year-old convent girls were walking home at night and passed by Highgate Cemetery. Their return journey from Highgate Village took them down Swains Lane.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't believe their eyes as they passed the north gate at the top of the lane, where what appeared to be emerging from tombs were dead bodies.
Oh, my.
One of these schoolgirls, Elizabeth, later suffered nightly visitations and indeed blood loss. There was another incident some weeks later where an engaged couple were walking down the same lane and saw pretty much the same sort of thing, but they had a much closer experience of a spectre which held them, almost paralyzed them, held them in its thrall. Others were soon reporting sightings. It eventually got into the local newspapers as in letters columns where people were recounting their experience, residents and passers-by. Eventually, it became a topic which was being discussed in the media and on television.
Why do certain areas, Bishop, like the Highgate area, why do they have these kinds of vampires in the area? Is there anything special about that region, or is it just coincidental?
It's not coincidental. I think in both the case of Highgate Cemetery and Kirklees, something came. Perhaps something was invited, but certainly something came to the area. Kirklees itself has a history of apostate nuns and bloodletting. Highgate has a very strange history, and it would be true to say that something definitely came to Highgate before even the cemetery existed. And there were reports of manifestations and spectres in certainly in the area of Swains Lane.
Is this happening all around the planet, not just in your region, England? Is it happening in South America, in the United States, Africa, the Middle East? Is this a situation that is just full-blown throughout the planet?
I think it is global. I think there's reports of this phenomenon have gone back to the beginning of records, really, to the classical world and beyond. In one form or another, the reports of what we now today refer to as vampirism exist. I think that there are areas of where the concentration is worse, and certainly parts of the Western world, England, London, seems to attract the diabolical. Perhaps there are, and for some time have been, people that have been working to that end, to conjure, to evoke, to invite, to raise, to call up, to open, as you say, the portal.
Right. Which is there. There's no doubt in my mind that it is there. And
yes, I mean, this German couple, now serving however many years, 15 years or 12 years respectively, the Ruders, allegedly came to London where they discovered vampire cults. They also visited Scotland, but it was in London, working in one such club. One of the couple claims to have been introduced to the world of a vampirism. And they went back and, of course, murdered a colleague in a very horrible manner.
And that's pure evil.
Yes. You have a similar, probably several similar incidents in America, not least of all Roderick Ferrell, now serving, I think he's on death row, awaiting the electric chair.
What did he do?
He murdered the parents of a cult member. The judge described in the summing up that there is genuine evil in the world, a dark side and a light side competing in each of us. And speaking to Ferrell, he said, "There is no doubt on which side you went."
Yes.
Of course, these people are vampiroids, or people who belong to a vampiroidic subculture, not to be confused with the real thing. But, like the real thing, the end result is death and possibly even worse, the destruction of the soul.
Jeez. The destruction of the soul. Stay with us. My guest is the Right Reverend Bishop Sean Manchester. Whew. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest, the Reverend Bishop Sean Manchester. Reverend, have you ever been attacked by a vampire?
Yes, that occasion is recorded in my book on the subject, The Highgate Vampire. Yes, I have been assaulted by a vampire entity on an occasion. Yes,
to the point where perhaps you were concerned about your own safety. How were you able to?
I'm always concerned about my own safety in those situations. But I've only been physically attacked in the physical sense of the word on one occasion in the early 80s.
Tell me how that happened.
Well, it is a part of the story, and taken out of context is difficult really to describe.
Okay.
But it certainly was a very worrying experience, and it did actually leave wounds in my palm of my left hand, which are visible almost still today.
Could you
so
see?
There is a tangible side to all this. There's always been a tangible side. I mean, you ask me why are they attracted to certain places.
Yes.
It's just interesting that when I was researching the history of Highgate, for example, that 700 years prior, a castle dominated the place. It loomed some 350 feet above sea level, which would have at that point been outside of London. Now part of North London, of course. And by the 16th century, all that remained was a heap of rubble overgrown with bushes and trenched with two deep ditches. By the turn of the 18th century, there was an impressive three-story mansion known as Ashurst House on the spot. This still precedes, obviously, the time of the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around this time, in the first quarter of the 18th century, that incidents began to haunt, strange incidents began to be reported of hauntings in the area, reports of hobs, ghosts, and demons abounding. And it just so happens that, of course, in that first quarter of the 18th century, the vampire epidemics swept across Europe and reached our shores. The mansion was eventually sold in 1830, and Highgate Cemetery was opened in 1839 in the grounds of what once belonged to that mansion. Just 6 years afterwards, Highgate itself was made a parish, or 6 years before,
mm-hmm.
And the 17 acres of grassy hillside soon became known as one of the most fashionable and indeed beautiful resting places in London, where many celebrities are interred. Something happened there whether it was connected with the strange goings-on of previous centuries or not, people with ill intent came to Highgate to raise or evoke through forms of necromancy, diabolism, something which they believed to be there. And either they were successful or it was successful without their help.
Right.
But something certainly awakened if it was dormant, or entered if it was waiting to be unlocked. Wreaked havoc throughout the 60s, 70s, and its consequences reverberated on after that.
Can you equate the kind of evil that you've been studying all these years with what I continue to hear, the end times, the end times? I mean, is there a correlation between those?
I would say so. I mean, when we're not supposed to identify the moment, as it were, but it certainly seems to be the consensus among many Christians of all denominations, irrespective of whether they're Protestant evangelicals or traditional Catholics, that does, or indeed Orthodox, whom we shouldn't forget, of course, there does seem to be a feeling that we are now in the final conflict. And that this would, of course, explain much that's been happening, and would make it better understood why these manifestations are more and more coming to the fore. All sorts of manifestations, of which what we've been discussing is just one tiny, small aspect. And it will probably, as I predicted years ago in at least two of my books, From Satan to Christ and the Highgate Vampire, it will probably get worse, because this is possibly the final and inevitable conflict.
Will it be dramatically worse?
Yes, I think it will. What amazes me personally is the large numbers of people today who are sleepwalking throughout the whole drama. People who either are oblivious to what is going on, or those that are vaguely aware are playing the ostrich, which seems to be very popular nowadays, sticking their head in the ground.
Yeah, and never coming back out.
And there are a tiny few who are engaged in spiritual warfare. I'm just absolutely astonished that more people are not waking up to what is happening around them, in their midst, possibly right on their doorstep, but certainly visibly all around them. Everything is happening. More is happening in a single year, a single month perhaps, than has happened for centuries ahead of us, behind us.
And that's pretty scary. That's
yes,
pretty scary.
And unless people take hold of the reins, it will remain out of control, and we'll be suffering the consequences. I mean, I suffer the consequences all the time by speaking about these things, because, for example, I mean, earlier this year I was on a live radio show, but in the United Kingdom.
Okay.
For an hour, and I couldn't get across any of the things I've been discussing with you, because I was all the time dealing with a very hostile presenter who was just quite clearly from the very beginning determined to give abuse, mm-hmm, and offense and insult, and that became the only thing that was being bandied from the presenter to the interviewer.
Did it get to the point where you wanted to get up and just walk out?
Well, I mean, I'm not that sort of person.
Okay.
And they probably were aware of that. But they themselves cut me off after a few minutes simply because I asked what on earth was happening. Why was I being treated like this? I'd come on at their invitation, no fee. I'd asked for nothing in return, had nothing to sell, had nothing to to proselytize other than I had accepted their invitation.
Mm-hmm.
But they had obviously invited me on to abuse and to try and discredit me on the say-so of what was clearly a Satanist who'd been interviewed some months previously. It didn't work, and the presenter very quickly pulled the plug, and then his producer got onto him and he got back in touch with me. But the whole thing was kept at a very, a level where it was impossible to impart any useful information because of the attitude and the behavior of that particular presenter, who was not going to allow any kind of dialogue or conversation that would result in people being informed properly. He was only out to ridicule and make fun. There's that aspect. There's that side of the coin. The other side of the coin is absolute censorship. I mean, for example, and not coincidentally, I suspect, in the early hours of Midsummer, 21st of June this year, my websites were locked out.
Oh, really?
Not just the Vampire Research website, to which I have enormous input, but my personal church website, which has an outreach ministry on it, which is what definitely caused the lockout. And I remained locked out for 3 weeks and could only return on condition that, in the case of the Christian website, Holy Grail, that clearly one-third of it had to remain locked out. It couldn't be uploaded because of its sensitive material. And it was made clear that certain material on the Vampire Research website, which you've kindly mentioned, that too cannot return on the internet. Now, when you consider the absolute pornography and violence and disgusting, blasphemous rubbish that you can find with such ease on the internet, it's everywhere.
I was going to say, you're being censored, yet some of this junk that is on the internet flows freely.
Absolutely. And one has to wonder why. Who on earth would take the trouble to try and censor something which is clearly opening up a debate, offering some evidence, some information, and pointing to where some of the problems might lie. And I'm being told that if you want to remain up on the internet, you'll have to curtail some of that, because there are people it is clearly annoying. Now,
is there a bigger agenda here, Bishop?
Well, yes. I mean, there are people in the UK, and they have their counterparts elsewhere, who are running campaigns to get me, off of everything, off the air, off the internet, literally out of the public domain.
Are you that controversial out there?
I wouldn't have thought so, but clearly I think the problem is that, unlike certain other people, not necessarily anyone I've named, they are not taken seriously at all. And perhaps I have been taken seriously. Perhaps I've provided too much evidence. Perhaps I've investigated too thoroughly. Perhaps I've trod on too many toes by daring to point the finger and by exposing and revealing some of the, after all, criminal personalities that have been behind some of this work, people who themselves have been judged by their peers to be meriting prison sentences. I've actually been prepared to be a witness myself in the past, and clearly there are groups of people who are sufficiently concerned about that to campaign for my removal off the internet and off of other areas of media contact. And they have been, to some small extent, successful.
Well, are those who are out there who subscribe to demonology and vampirism, are they that powerful?
Yes, I would suggest they are. I would say that they're in all strata of government institutions. Whether you refer to them as a global elite, the Illuminati, or Illuminized Freemasonry, secret societies, Satanists, devil worshippers, whatever the label you use, we're talking about the same cabal, the same tiny group of manipulative, powerful people behind the scenes who do have their lower orders, their rank and file, in organizations like the church, the judiciary, the police, the government, local government authorities, but the people at the top, the people who actually call the tune, the people that set brother against brother, they are the ones that would, I would suggest, not want it to be known what is going on. There are one or two people who have been blowing the whistle. Most people who hold traditionalist views or are aware of this tend to keep a low profile. For various reasons. Those of us that haven't kept such a low profile are have become targets, either to be dismissed as absolute lunatics or to be ridiculed, held up for ridicule, or to be censored. And
Well, do you have much support from the church for the work you do?
Not as much as you might expect. I think the church itself is embarrassed by those in its own midst. I mean, it has its own problems.
Well,
clearly
sure, we know that.
Yes, and that is a symptom of just how bad the corruption has become. I'm prepared to stand up and be counted and to point the finger and to say, this is unacceptable, and if you don't deal with this, you're unacceptable. And they don't welcome that. But clearly it has to get its own house in order. Whether it can or not, I don't know, because this corruption, this...
Well, let's call it this evil.
...has been taking place for some time. And the infiltration, we're certainly aware of, has been taking place since the last World War. But it's not just the institution of the church. All manner of institutions have been, to some degree, infiltrated. And the mindset of many people now falls in line with those who infiltrated all that time ago, which is, there is no such thing as the supernatural. God and the devil are only ideas that we, excuse me, subscribe to. They're taking the view of Jungian and Freudian view of psychological view of reality, not indeed a view which is held by many people in witchcraft and Satanism, that in fact it's only the power of your mind, that demons and angels, yes, they exist, but only in your mind, and you conjure them from your mind. That's a view held by much of psychiatry. However, it isn't my view, and it isn't the view of traditionalists, because evil exists as an external reality, not merely a lack of something. It's an effective agent, a living, spiritual being, perverted and perverting, mysterious and frightening. You know, the profanity, perversion, and every miserable form of corruption that nowadays is finding toleration, where once it was rightly condemned, is born of this evil.
Now, I understand...
flourishes in an atmosphere of sickening depravity and moral bankruptcy.
Your time is limited. I wish you could stay with us one more hour, but you cannot. Is that correct?
That's true. I have a prior engagement. I do apologize to both you and all your listeners, and I thank you profusely from the bottom of my heart and from the depths of my soul for allowing me this one last opportunity, if that is what it is, to speak to the people out there and to tell them not to give up, to be part of the conflict which is already ensuing, and to be on the side of the righteous, to be on the side of good and of God, with God.
You have to fight evil. Thank you so much, the Reverend Sean Manchester.